Hey there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, we hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs we have one of our favorite guests, Mr. Matt Finch. He's the Ennie Award winner, the creator of the first ever D&D retro clone, Swords and Wizardry, Osric, the quick primer on old school gaming, and Matt currently has a big Swords and Wizardry expansion that's on Kickstarter. We're going to be talking about all that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into it, I'll remind everyone that, as always, at the very end of the show, we will be hosting our live after-party chat. That is a live chat on our Discord server with Dan and I, and special guest today, Matt Finch. So Matt will be joining us. So if you want to join in on that live video chat, you can do so by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, bid at any tier, and you will get an invite to our private Discord server. And around maybe 2:10 Eastern time today, we will be over there hosting our live video chat. So please join us.
We'll look forward to that. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's always fun to be on the show.
We're being informed by our chief aide-de-camp, William, that Matt Finch is hereby joining the Wandering DMs Five Timers Club. So I think you might be the first, actually. So we'll get a jacket over to you soon. Official Wandering DMs apron or something like that. So I'm so glad you still have the patience for us, Matt.
Whether it's an apron or a jacket makes it more or less likely that I will wear it at a convention.
We'll discuss in the after chat which is which, fans. So you tune in for that. In a separate discussion. But let's talk about your Kickstarter, Matt. So yeah. we were thrilled to see this up. Swords and Wizardry it's both foundational and it's one of our favorite retro clones to have at the table when we need to direct people to old school D&D that's well presented. So maybe start by telling us there's a number of books you've got going on here. Maybe give us an overview of what you got in this Kickstarter.
Yeah, let me just give a quick overview because it's all on the Kickstarter page. But so basically, you've got essential Swords and Wizardry, you know, being in the rule book, and a lot of people just like the archetypal, game as it is. And so, but a lot of people want to have expansions and new options and so on and so forth. So, you know, that's why it's segregated in a second book called the Book of Options, which has, it's got a lot of stuff in it. It's got 11 new character classes. If you want to really, you know, go full on Arduin, it's got 11 character classes. It's got two new ancestries, one of which is gnomes, since that's not in the original Swords and Wizardry. And then it's also got something called a Stygian, which is a serpent folk type of background. It's got new spells, a few new spells. That's not the most exciting part because most of this come from AD&D as an option, you know, to put into, you know, an OD&D. It has got lots and lots of new spells that are related to the new character classes. It's got a section of advice for the referee, which I think we're going to end up focusing on fairly heavily in this show, which has, some tables for, you know, how to do a first adventure. A little bit about building a campaign. It's got a discussion of alignment, the three axis alignment versus the nine axis alignment. It's got a revised copy of the Quick Primer for Old School Gaming, which will go out as a free PDF after the Kickstarter. I guess that's pretty much it. Oh, and a bunch of encounter tables also in the Book of Options, which ties into the monster book that's going out with it, which has got 300 new monsters. Most of them have been seen before. There's about 40 brand new monsters that have never, seen publication before. A lot of nice illustration. in the monster book. It's got Tomb of the Iron God, which is a module I wrote a long time ago that's, you know, basically refurbished so that to bring it into the product line from Mythmere Games. And Domain of Herringard, which is the start of a new campaign world. And that's sort of like the Judges Guild, you know, here's a small area, small area, small area. And the various things that are important for starting a new campaign world. So there's, you know, there's also a discussion of alignment in there, about, you know, a little bit about planes, so on and so forth. So that's the overview of the Kickstarter as a whole. There's a ton of new material coming out. So, so that's the overview. And then, you know, we can dive into whatever parts of that you guys want to talk about the most.
So viewers, to be clear, the three of us here kind of want to dig into like theoretical D&D stuff and Matt's revision of the old school primer that we have been waiting for a number of years, actually, and things like that. Before we get to that, let me ask this, Matt. So you have a bunch of new classes here, including like Bard, Barbarian, Illusionist, something like Cavalier, an Elfblade, things like that. And Paul and I have kind of a very long-running occasional series on what we would refer to as subclasses in D&D. So I'm kind of wondering what the mechanics are. And I have a love-hate relationship with it, honestly. I go back and forth about the best way to present, you know, the new classes that players obviously want. So one thing I was wondering is that D&D has cycled back and forth between are your new classes subsets of old classes. So like in first edition, clearly if you're a druid, you also have to follow all the rules for clerics and all the requirements for clerics automatically. And then you get to third edition and they were careful to make all these classes totally independent. And now with next fifth edition, they're going back and they're again consolidating these classes into class categories exactly the way they used to do in second edition. So would you want to call your classes subclasses? Are they referring to major classes or are they totally independent all the time?
They're totally independent all the time. I'm not, I don't think of things for the most part as being, you know, an overall class and then a subclass. I think that caused some problems with second edition D&D having, you know, druids and clerics both as subclasses of a priest. I think that especially given that this is a book of optional material that we're not trying to get people to necessarily put into the game, it's just like, here it is, you can put it in if you want to, that having everything as a freestanding class is, you know, number one, more interesting because it gives you a little bit more flexibility in terms of the things that you, you know, put into the class. Number two, it makes it feel more modular, and modularity is the, you know, the main issue here. So it's definitely along the lines of the they're not subclasses, they're freestanding things, and you know, in that way, your necromancer, yeah, it's a lot like a cleric, it's a lot like a magic user, but it's not either one of the two of those. It's a necromancer; it has its own spell list. You know, same with the demon hunter. Although the demon hunter is very, very much like a magic user, but you know, I think they've got better hit dice and slightly better armor, but not as good as a fighter, but they have, you know, a bunch of spells and, you know, some of the classes in there, especially the ones that were designed by James Spahn, he followed a method of slowly giving spells and slowly increasing the level on spells for something that had other abilities as well on top of those spells. And so there you have something that's very much, you know, so the troubadour is very much an inferior illusionist, but they've got thief skills and so on and so forth. And so he used a different kind of spell progression than you normally saw in OD&D. So there's a lot, you know, it's most definitely the freestanding character class, not the subclass approach.
Cool. That makes sense. Cool. Smart. Let me ask this. Okay, so you've got a class called a warlock. And yeah. I have opinions about like the fifth edition warlock. How much is your warlock like the fifth edition warlock where they just have free spells all the time? Do they use Vantian casting or not?
They do use Vancian casting, but they, okay, so remember the Sorcerer in third edition where you have a character class that's got a certain limited number of spells. They can access any spell from the list, but it's still using Vancian casting in the sense that you have used a spell slot and it's fire and forget. It's not fire and forget, actually, because you could use it again, but it's access to a very limited pool of spells, but you can pick which one you need. So that's the way that the Warlock is done. It doesn't emulate the fifth edition Warlock other than in concept, because really fifth edition was really when they finally came up with a class that was here. You've made a pact with something that's powerful enough to give you spells, but you're not a cleric and it's not a god necessarily. So just, you know, the basic witch, you know, that's what a witch, you know, is looking back at medieval folklore. It's somebody who made a bargain with the devil or whatever. And so bringing that folkloric class into play was the real goal, but he actually used the sorcerer mechanic to do it.
Cool. Smart. Those seem like good options for things that our players, you know, commonly ask about whether it's available or something like that. So I think that makes sense. And to be clear, your Kickstarter has already funded. So people that join it, we have a link in the YouTube description right now. You know, the product is definitely going to be delivered, and you've already reached your major stretch goal. So in addition to the player options book and the monsters and the entire campaign setting and the referee screen, you also have a player character sheet.
Forgot the referee screen. Right? There's a referee screen in there, which is gorgeous.
Yeah.
The stretch goal is a PDF of stat blocks for all of the 22 character classes that are now, you know, arguably a part of the game, from first level to ninth level. So it's really, that's mostly a referee tool, but it's real helpful to be able to cut and paste stat blocks if you have to assemble a caravan really quickly or something like that. And then also there are character reference sheets, which is just a short PDF with the rules for a particular character class. And that's really just so that you can print something off and give it to somebody who's playing for the first time.
That's great. And of course, if any of our viewers don't know, if you're a follower of the Wandering DMs here, we have our own custom house rules that we call the OED house rules. And it's basically an OSR type thing. And Matt's Swords and Wizardry products are all very directly compatible with that. So you can definitely mix and match our products with Matt's, of course. We just put the link in the chat right now. Thanks to William for that. So you can go and join Matt's Kickstarter anytime you like. I want to talk about the revision to the quick primer to old school gaming, if that's mm-hmm. okay. And sure. Interestingly, the very first time that the three of us met, which was at TotalCon almost exactly 4 years ago to the day. I think tomorrow is the fourth anniversary of the three of us meeting for the first time. And one of the very first things that you said to us, Matt, is, and we were asking about the old school primer, and you said, you know, I really ought to revise it at some point because I initially wrote it in the context of third edition, and now mm-hmm. in the context of fifth edition, there's different emphases that I should possibly make. And we're like, we want to read that. And we finally did this morning. Say it again.
I got right on that. I finished it within 4 years.
Just 4 year turnaround. It's great. You know, it's funny because back in like 2010 or so, when I first ran my first old school, I was running BX at the time. That was one of the first things I did, honestly, is I found that your primer and I printed it out, stapled it into little booklets, and I handed it out to my players. And I said, you got to read this. This is, you know, you will understand how I'm running the game once you read this booklet. So we really appreciate that being out there in the world. I'm excited to hear that you're going to make it generally available outside the book as well. Because I would love to continue to do that. I think it's still needed to this day.
Yeah, I think so. I had a conversation with somebody or other who was, you know, there's still always the issue of how do I introduce people to, you know, old school gaming. And he was talking about how, you know, well, the general advice on the internet is, you know, lie to the players and tell them, it's basically the same, and then try it out. And I was like, I think that's terrible.
I hate that that so much. I'm sorry. I hate that so much because people have done that to me. Like I've had that done to me at conventions, and I'm enraged by it.
Yeah, it's like gamers are not stupid, especially when you're talking about games.
Right. Right. Exactly. So what? Right off the bat. Right. So when I read your introduction, and it's thoughtful and it's clever, and it's if you were hunting on this on your own, don't read the introduction. Just read the rest of it. But if someone handed it to you like Paul did, you should read this introduction about what this is about. And so right off the bat, the idea that there's kind of two ends of a continuum of how you do role playing. And interestingly, on mine at the moment, I'm currently going through Peter Perla's The Art of Wargaming, which starts with a couple chapters about the history of wargaming, where this kind of hobby comes from. And right off the bat, it struck me in Perla's book that the fundamental distinction, the fundamental debate between what was originally called in Europe free Kriegspiel versus rigid Kriegspiel of is the referee making up a bunch of interpretations on the fly to make sense? Or do you have a large comprehensive body of rules and math that tries to cover everything? This debate has been happening since the 1800s. And so right off the bat in the first paragraph, that's the fundamental thing that you're trying to communicate between newer D&D, which tries to be comprehensive, and older school, which puts a lot of power in the hands of the DM. And it really just struck me that we're going on approximately 200 years of this same kind of debate. And I think it's useful to be clear about that.
And I think it's fundamental, it's a fundamental divide between games pretty much of any kind. Is there a human component involved in the refereeing of it? Or are you trying to keep that to an absolute minimum because you're trying to be, usually the goal is to be simulationist by having the rules, but it also, fits with a certain mindset of player, having the rules comprehensive. Usually it's, a player that doesn't entirely trust the person who's been given this big role of interpreting, and they'd rather not have a person in there so that they don't doubt the outcome. It's just two different psychologies, not that one's right or wrong. I do think it's picking up something that's very fundamental to games in general.
What would you say is the top things that you felt you had to revise in this new draft?
Well, the first thing is boring, but it's just terminology because the first one was written, contrasting two approaches, and the terminology being used for the new school description is simply wrong nowadays because it was using third edition terminology, and now most people coming to this will have started with playing fifth edition. So, I was switching from talking about a spot check to a perception check, very small things there. And I also tried to downplay a little bit the characterization of the new school approach to simply describing this as how it would be done, because a lot of people when they were reading the original version of the Quick Primer took it as being that I was trying to that I was saying that one is better than the other, which is not, I think, the case. I happen to prefer the old school approach. What I'm trying to do is not argue one versus the other. What I'm trying to do is say, I happen to prefer the old school. This is how it's done. So that's really the the issue. So it's probably that. I downplayed slightly, well, I didn't downplay anything, but it seemed to me that the fundamental issue, and it's very close to the rulings, not rules thing, but was using the word improvisational. The rules have an improvisational element to them in an old school game. And that, I think, zeroed in more on what's really going on in terms of characterizing what I was talking about. So there's that new emphasis. The word improvisational shows up several times.
I think that's great. That's it's a word I use often just when trying to at the table at a convention, trying to explain how what we're about to play is different from what perhaps the players are used to. I will say I'm a very improvisational GM. you know, I'm going to make up a lot of stuff as we go. Something that really jumped out to me in reading it, and I see what you're saying about, like, I remember in the original one, there was some text there about, like, hey, the modern style GM sounds kind of boring, but because I'm just trying to exemplify the differences. And right. I understood what you're saying in that, but also I could see how that maybe took away from the message a little bit. So I was actually,
right,
I was
exactly
pleased to see that, kind of just get rid of that.
And what I did also was took out the characterization of that, you know, of that new school DM, and just said, these are the procedures that would be used in fifth edition, as opposed to these are the procedures and the points at which there is a decision that has to be made by the referee using the old school.
I'm trying to find it now in your new text that I was looking at this morning, and I'm failing to find it. But there was a point there that you made that I thought was fantastic, which was about how often the referee is also surprised. And I feel like that's such a great observation.
That popped out at me as well. I actually also quoted that same thing. The referee will be just as surprised by the results as the players are.
That's my favorite thing about the sort of old school DMing approach, you know, is that, you know, you're surprised a lot, you know, you're playing a game as well as the ref, you know, in your role as the referee, you're still playing a game. And there's plenty of room for surprise to happen in there. And if you really, really, you know, to a ridiculous and, you know, degree, but theoretically, if you did have a game in which everything really was simulationist and every rule was covered and it just came down to a die roll, you know, then taken to the absolute theoretical extreme, that's really just a roll, a situation in which you're rolling dice and watching the world go by based on those random results. And, you know, I'm certainly not saying that that's what new school gaming is, but it is, that's the problematic direction that's headed in. Just as the old school, if you want to look at a problematic direction, it's something that has no rules at all, and it's just people sitting around and talking, and then it's not a game anymore. But, you know, those are the two sort of theoretical extremes.
Right. Agreed. Personally, when I was reading this, I got a sense of you being very both aware of currently published D&D and also very generous towards it, frankly. So the version here comes off as like, here's two possible approaches and consider for your personality which one matches the best. And your examples, you know, having tuned to the current mechanics and the current terminology, you know, display, you know, awareness of what of the specific details of how exactly fifth edition would run. We've had, you know, some other commentators and we've had some guests on the show that are even more ideological than that. And they're just, you know, new school gaming sucks. End of story. That's as much analysis they put into it. So the fact that you have the specifics nailed down, I think really gives a lot more weight to your analysis as you compare and contrast the two. So I thought that came off very, very generously myself.
Well, you know, fifth edition is obviously, it's a very, very popular game, and it's, you know, things have been moving in that direction, although more, you know, with third edition. So you can't just dismiss, you know, the fact that, you know, tons and tons of people, you know, really enjoy that style of game. But the question is, you know, there are, I think, a lot of those people who actually would enjoy an old school approach more. It's just they don't know it because they're not seeing it out there. It's not, you know, the OSR is fairly big and fairly well known, but it's nowhere near the kind of reach that Wizards of the Coast has in marketing, you know, Dungeons and Dragons. So, you know, we're still very much the underdog approach in the world.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate the tone in there, though. Of, I know that it's very difficult in writing to say, you know, there are two different ways of doing a thing, and this text is opinionated in that it wants to do it this way, and I want to exemplify the difference between my way and the other way without necessarily saying that the other way is bad, right?
Yeah.
So I very much appreciate that. Like, there are just two different ways, and our opinion is we want to do it this way. So I think that's wise, right? I think that's, I don't know, it's nice to see it presented that way, I think.
There was,
I'm curious, and I'll also Matt, say, if I can ask,
go ahead.
All right, I want to follow up. You mentioned that the original primer was written, you know, from a third edition perspective, and a lot of the updating here was to get it ready for, or to switch the context to talk more about fifth. How much was in your mind of having to prepare for the next version?
Oh,
yeah, none, because we really don't know. We don't know socially what that edition is going to look like. I can make a lot of guesses about what the rules are going to look like, and I think that's more specific now because they are going to definitely want to sell it as being 5.5 rather than as edition 6. So I think we're not going to see drastic structural rule changes to it. So I can make a pretty good guess about what it's going to look like. But the real question, and what I think Hasbro is pushing, they are certainly trying to make it more digital, more online. They would certainly prefer to be selling electronic documents rather than physical books, especially in an inflationary environment that's going to probably hit them a little bit harder than it hits the consumers. So I think we're going to continually see more and more pressure to get online with the game rather than to sit down with a bunch of friends and play, even though when you sit down with a bunch of friends and play, you are, I think, way more likely to stick with that game and keep playing it. So, I mean, I think that's in some ways, as one would expect a large company to do, they're focusing on the more immediate bottom line rather than on the very long-term arch of what their products are going to have continuing customers and so on, you know. But, you know, corporations do tend to be more short-sighted than they ought to be. And I suspect that that's going on here. And since what I think the real change here is going to be is the question of, does D&D largely stay a tabletop game, or does it become something that is more seen as an online sort of environment? That would probably be the next thing that might cause some sort of alteration in terms of talking about old school. We may be entering an era where there is a second element to old school versus new school, which is, are you playing at a table or are you playing online?
Yeah.
Fascinating. I mean,
that is actually these days the first question I ask people when they start telling me, like, oh, well, you play D&D. I like play D&D too. I'm playing this kind of campaign. Mm-hmm. And the first question I always end up with is, are you playing around a table or online? And it seems to be the major breakpoint these days.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Whoa. Now I'm filled with existential dread all of a sudden. you know, I saw a quote from, the founder of SPI, Jim Dunnigan, categorizing war games, again, pre-D&D, war games as essentially, what is the essence of this hobby? It's a non-linear communication between humans, was his take on it, which is not something I would have thought of, but it's an interesting perspective. It's fundamentally about communications between humans. And it does seem like a really good point that it might be challenging to have a robust culture around it the more you're removing the human being element from it. Really fascinating. So,
Matt, I ran into this just last weekend at a convention, as I was mentioning earlier, and I would love to get your take on this. And maybe I can pose this as a sort of like, how would you have handled this situation?
Case study.
Case study, if you will. I was running an original edition D&D game. I had about five players sitting around and at the table, and I had one young man right across from me, handed a character sheet that was a halfling thief, they were dealing with a large camp of threatening human warriors that might invade a nearby village that they wanted to prevent. And they were trying to find ways that were not combat to deal with the problem. And he's looking at his character sheet and he says, oh, can I use my charisma to convince them to go away, to just not attack the village? And I thought it was such a fascinating thing for me because I'm like, you're almost there, but you're not quite. I'm curious, I guess, do you agree? And like, how would you respond to that question?
Well, I'd be like, you know, first of all, you know, all right, what's your charisma? Do you remember roughly what it was? Was it low,
yeah.
High, medium?
Yeah, no, that's I think the interesting thing, and I think where the question was coming from, because as you looked at his character sheet, sure enough, his character had a 17 charisma. Great.
All right, so so here's your character. You know, keep in mind, you know, visualize this situation. You're really short. You're looking up at these large, you know, human fighters out there. They're looming over the top of you. But you're very persuasive because you've got that high charisma. So, you know, think of your, you know, now don't put down the character sheet for a second and just visualize these people there. Okay, now what are you going to do? Are you going to step forward and strike a pose, or are you going to be, you know, friendly? Give me an idea of what you're kind of, how you're going to kind of approach it. And then as the thing moves on, it's like, well, it's a question of what do you say? You know, this is just, you know, you and me right now. It's not the character sheet. This is you playing a character. So what is it that you want to say visualizing this situation? That's how I would approach it.
There's a nice way of, I mean, it's great. And I love that you're emphasizing, like, put down the character sheet, right? Because that's the thing I was struggling with, is that I think he was really looking at it as like, I'm looking at my character sheet. I see a big number. I want to, mm-hmm. you know, use that mechanic, right? And so he was focused on the mechanic rather than the mm-hmm. situation. And I was like, I like what you're asking. I like that you're thinking about interesting ways to accomplish the goal. But I couldn't figure out how to communicate this notion that I had in my head that, you know, it's more important what you do and your ideas, and your stats may influence it slightly. You might have a slightly better chance because you have that big number.
That's the big thing in there, yeah. is that you do want to tell people, here's what that does. And so if you dial back to the thing I was saying, okay, you have a 17 charisma. That means that you're very persuasive. And so it's telling them, this is what I think that stat does. This is how it works. It makes you persuasive. Now, let's get into the situation where you're visualizing it, you knowing that your character is fairly quite persuasive with a 17 charisma. But not, you know, but that also says it's not going to be a die roll or anything like that. This is what that stat does. It means that you're going to be persuasive.
Nice. I like
you. You have a point. You have this point in your second Zen moment, which is player skill, not PC abilities, where you've got a piece of advice that says things are going well if people are reading the other people at the table, and not going so well if they're reading the player character sheet for what they can do next. You know, let me ask this. I've gotten in a little bit more lately of occasionally calling for the classic mechanic of roll a d20 and roll under your ability score for something. Uh-huh. I don't do it a lot, but I've done it a little bit more lately. And some of our viewers have critiqued that as saying, oh, but that emphasizes the ability scores more than traditional original D&D expected. Do you do that very much, Matt, or is that verboten for you?
No, I do that occasionally. I don't do it very often, but that's mainly because a lot of times I use a saving throw for the same thing. Just, you know, make a saving throw and we'll see how you do, which is similar, but that does emphasize the, you know, the attribute scores less. But, you know, I'm not at all doctrinaire about the idea that because OD&D didn't emphasize the attribute scores, that therefore you should never use or emphasize the attribute scores. I don't really have a distinction with that way or the other. I mean, I tend to think of things as, you know, you've got an overall toolbox, mental toolbox as the referee, and in it you've got the various modes of rolling dice, with the most common ones being a to-hit roll, a saving throw roll. You know, one of the things that could be in there would be, you know, rolling under your, you know, rolling under an attribute score. You know, roll a d6, and on a 1 or 2, it's success, or on a 1 or 2, it's failure. There's just a bunch of different die rolls that most people have that they're more or less, you know, likely to use in a particular situation. And I don't tend to feel that one of those necessarily has to usually be used in a certain situation, unless you've used it a lot with your players and your players are expecting that that's going to be the particular way you do it. And then, you know, it's kind of like a house rule and that's kind of the way that you do it. But I don't think I don't have any opposition to the idea of trying to roll under the attribute score. Although I will say that if I'm really that focused on a thing, I might actually go more with the involving difficulty in it as well, because the roll under the attribute score has no appreciation for how difficult the task is. All tasks are equally difficult, and it only has to do with you. Whereas, you know, we've seen brought into D&D over the years the idea of a difficulty class, where what you're rolling is trying to hit a target number with a bonus possibly coming from your stat. And I might be equally inclined to, you know, dream up, roll a d20, you're trying to beat such and such a number, partly just because I add more easily than I subtract, which is probably alien to you, Dan, because of the statistics background.
I'm highly, you know what, I actually think about this a lot, Matt. This is actually part of something I deal with in my mechanics a lot, is we all know that's true for everybody, including me, of course.
Yeah. So, you know, I would be more likely to mentally think of, you know, this is a roll of 15 or higher on a d20 kind of difficulty type thing. And you've got a good dexterity, so we're going to give you a +2, so roll higher than a 13. It might be something like along those. I'd probably be more likely to actually go that direction than to roll under the attribute.
Yeah, I like that take a lot. You know, the one case I always think of that I feel like is doing it right in that is just by the book on in some of the old school editions is like opening a stuck door, right? Usually it's in the adventure, maybe, that it will tell you something about, like, well, this door is swollen shut, or this door is locked, or this door is gated. There's a 1 in 6, 2 in 6, 4 in 6, whatever chance of opening the door. And then people with high strength have a bonus, right? A +1 or maybe +2 if you're really lucky on that roll. And I much prefer that kind of thing, right? Like, and I kind of wanted, in my case, right, I wanted to boil it down. If I go back to my use case of convincing the raiders to go away, right, I was like, well, normally maybe I would roll a reaction on a reaction chart, and because you have a high charisma, I'm going to give you a +1 or a +2 to it. But I don't. Yeah, I personally kind of try to move away from that, like just roll straight under the attribute, just because, like you said, because it's so tied to the attribute and not the situation.
Right.
Okay, brief devil's argument, right? So I will say, when using that mechanic, you can, you know, you could have, and you see this in some older modules, you could have a modifier to the ability, of course. So if you have a 10 strength, you could say this is very difficult. So we're going to subtract 4 from your strength, and that's the number you have to roll under now. Or if you have a bonus because someone's helping you, you add to the original number. And now you know the target you have to roll under. So good things are still adding and bad things are still subtracting. Well, one way you could do it, which, you know, happens in some mechanical systems, but I'm not going to be ideological about that. It's, you know, one option, depending on whatever your personality is. Now, one thing I'll say, Matt, on that issue of die rolls, I was happy that one thing that you modified in the quick primer was the contrasting examples of people looking for a pit trap in the darkness. And so you go through in current fifth edition terminology how that would work. And then in the old school encounter, you've got people saying, well, if you had a 10-foot pole, I would use it and I would automatically find the open pit, of course. But it's currently gone because it got consumed by a trapped idol. And so now we're going to maybe try something like pouring water. And if all else fails, and you're real careful about this, We're going to still allow the character a 1 in 6 chance to still find the pit. You're going to roll a d6. If it comes up a 1, and you have this very careful sidebar where you kind of defend that and you say, not every referee is going to roll to find something like this. We're referencing the standard rules to find secret doors or hear noises, which is maybe 1 or 2 on a d6 or something like that. So I was happy. I feel that the original quick primer, the one thing I would have collegially critiqued was that it was a little bit hard on the we never roll dice to find right. Secret things original D&D, and I was happy to see that get a slightly more nuanced take here.
Yeah. No, and I think, you know, and you can see sort of the reasons why you would do one approach versus the other. It's, you know, the simple message. You know, in the one, you know, a long time ago, and again, it was really just, you know, to sort of get it was to get people past the threshold, because I really think understanding what the old school style of play is, it's largely a threshold. It's an aha moment. It's an epiphany, however you characterize that. kind of a thing. But people, it tends to be, I don't get it. Oh my God. Okay. I get it. And then, and suddenly they've got all of it all at once. They understand. It's not so much about my character sheet. It's about me thinking it through. It's about, you know, so that was what I was trying to elicit in the first one, based on that observation of the fact that it tended to be a sudden, you know, all at once understanding threshold. And now a lot of the people who are reading this, you know, are going to be way familiar, talked to death about, you know, old school, you know, what the theory is and so on and so forth. So I did put in a little bit more nuance, you know, just, I think, you know, as you said, Dan, it, you know, I think it is a little bit better to include that nuance rather than to leave it out entirely for brute force simplicity. So, you know.
Nice. I think that's smart. One thing that occurred to me here, and in the current quick primer, it comes in later near the end in your summary, that for me is very much front loaded, is the pace of play. So for me, the pace and the tempo of play is really paramount. And I don't always get it right, but I feel like I'm trying to get a certain pace of play for interest. And I think that that's one thing we see, just like in the tempo of combat in fifth edition versus old school, is you make the point, the combats go so much faster. You might have a wandering encounter and it's over in 5 minutes, right? And in fifth edition, I routinely hear, we got like maybe two fights done in 4 hours or something like that. And so for me, and you make the point, I mean, I think it's the great point in the first Zen moment that all of us, that many of us know, ruling's not rules. And the idea that in new school D&D, there's the idea the players need to learn the rules. And I've seen YouTube videos of people saying, well, I'm going to play a new character next week, and I got to sit down with the book, and I got to learn this week, and I really got to study and learn how to play a fighter. So that's going to take a lot of studious effort and really, really analysis in how to run a fighter. Whereas in old school, there was the expectation that you could throw players into the mix, not have them learn any rules. And on the referee side, not only, you know, does the referee not have to, you know, expect to remember a whole lot of rules, but for me critically, there's not the expectation that you have to stop the game and look in the book over and over again. So I see a lot of modern games where it's something comes up like, I know there's a rule for this. I know there's a rule for jumping somewhere, and we're going to stop. I'm going to crack open the book. I'm going to find it, and we're going to get that jumping rule just right after about 10 minutes of the game being on pause. And I've seen like discussions on Stack Exchange of this issue. It's like, we took 10 minutes to look up this rule, and I would come in as an old school and say, just don't worry about it. Just make up a ruling, move on, and then study it later. So maybe you'll get it right next game. And I've had responses of like, but we bought fifth edition. We have the rules for fifth edition, and we studied them, and I set my character up for this, and we're going to be offended if you claim to be running fifth edition, you don't stop the game to use the proper rule. And for me, that thing, that stop, look in the book, stop the game is for me really huge. It's the difference for me.
Okay, but let me devil's advocate you on that, like you did with me. There's a lot of old schoolers who would do the same thing. You know, we're playing this because we're trying to play original D&D, you know, as it was in 1974. So we're going to, by God, look up the rule. Now, granted, you've probably got fewer pages to check when you do that, but
right.
You know, I think that, you know, that is probably still a thing. But here's the difference, I think, that runs between, you know, older school and newer school, would be that if you're playing, you know, the older school kind of approach, it's somehow more valid for the referee to say, you know what, I'm just going to come out with a quick ruling on how we're going to handle this. You know, we can look it up later, but I want to keep things moving, so we're going to do it this way. Partly because you have that ability to make the ruling is in writing for the referee, and so that's part of the rules. And there's always been the whole rule zero, is that, you know, the final ruling is always with the referee, but it's more integral to the older style, where the players recognize, you know, this talk about, you know, the social contract at the table. The players recognize that part of the referee's job is pacing. And therefore, if you're running into a problem with pacing, it's part of your job to cut through it and say, let's do it this way. Whereas in fifth edition, with that less emphasized, and I bet you it's more emphasized in the rule books. If you actually read the rule books, I'm betting you anything that there's going to be some stuff in there that does give the referee, you know, the DM, the ability to do that. But people don't read that or focus on it as much. But, you know, there's more of the sense that your contract at the table is that you're going to be playing by the rules, rather than the sense that your contract at the table is going to be that the DM is responsible for pacing, is responsible for, you know, the speed at which things are doing, and that you can absolutely just be like, okay, we're going to do it this way. So.
Great.
A lot of it. And that was one of the, that was actually one of the emphases that I wanted to put into this newer version of the Quick Primer too, is the idea of the social contract at the table, and you know, the fact that everyone's sitting down with certain expectations, and that is very fundamental to the way that the game ends up playing out when you're doing it. And there are certain slightly different underlying assumptions, as largely as to whether you're going to be playing an improvisational game or not. And with the old school, you're playing a more improvisational game in terms of the rules, that it's perfectly okay to just be like, okay, here's how it's going to be done.
I love this emphasis on improvisation. All the players that I play with here in New York, every single one of them have done onstage improv comedy at some point. And we've had, it's so true. A great guest we've had in the past, her name is Karen Twelves, and she has a book on improv for gamers that she does seminars on. My partner, Isabel, just wrapped up a course in improv. And I was at an improv showcase last Saturday, seeing the results of her class's education. So that's very much part of the gestalt of you know, our gaming community, and I really loved seeing that emphasized more in the old school primer, because it's very near and dear to our hearts here. Now, okay, the hour is flying by. All right, okay. So I have got to get in before we run out of time. I've got to get in the question that on top of all this other great stuff in your Swords and Wizardry Book of Options, you have a bulked up, expanded discussion of alignment. And yes. it's very careful, and it's very thoughtful. And you go back to the inception of what we consider to be the alignment system from the works of Michael Moorcock, in addition to Lovecraft and so forth. But there's a whole lot of discussion here about what Michael Moorcock exactly meant by law and chaos and balance and neutrality, and your interpretation of it, Matt, and your advice for how to best to use it in the game. And so, as I mentioned, you coincidentally, in our last episode, we had the good fortune, we had Mike Moorcock on the show two weeks ago, and I made a specific point to ask him about his perspective on alignment in the Elric stories these days. And so, I was looking at the bit here to see how closely this dovetails
to what Mike just told us in the last episode.
Okay, I was super surprised. Okay, so I asked him, and I feel like one of the things, and so obviously Mike has written for a long period of time, and one of the things that this highlighted for me is that when you talk about some really super famous author and you say, what did they think about X? Well, that changes over time. And there's what they thought as in their first book, and then in their middle career and their late career evolved. And there's, we contain multitudes, and there's a whole different bunch of evolutions to Mike Moorcock and other authors. So the thing that really struck me when I asked him,
you end up coming out with a revised Quick Primer for old school games.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Right. So caution, you might need some errata there, but So Mike's not a gamer, but I was really stunned that what he said, well, how I feel now about it is he said, is he described something that completely parallels Gary Gygax's evolution resulting in the AD&D system of 9 alignments. Is Mike absolutely told us 2 weeks ago, well, he says, well, now, you know, when I started, I thought that basically law was good and chaos was evil. But now I think you can be lawful and also evil, or you could be chaotic and you could also be good. And I feel there's a lot more gradations to that. And that was frankly the last thing that I expected to hear. But he's evolved completely independently in a very similar way to first edition Advanced D&D. I don't know what your take is on that, Matt. Does that blow up? Does that blow up our whole understanding of original D&D now?
No, I don't think so. In fact, you know, so adding a third person to the mix along that arc. So what I say, and I may be slightly wrong about this because there's a discussion of alignment in the book of options. There's also a discussion of alignment in the domain of Herring Garden. So I may crisscross those over accidentally while I'm talking. Here's the sort of view that I've got on it is that with OD&D, when you've got a three alignment system, you pretty much have to, not have to, that OD&D was written with an implicit idea that law didn't mean without regard to the common good, that law, as it's described in OD&D, presumes that people at various levels of a hierarchy are still operating for the common good. In other words, goodness as opposed to evil, and so what you get there is something that corresponds much more to the sort of medieval Catholic notion of a divine law that includes good, you know, good and generous and mercy, and, you know, list any of the chivalric codes, you know, to get the other stuff that's implicit within law. And that this idea of brutal don't care sort of law that most people ascribe to Moorcock, that only really makes sense in a gaming environment when you have the 9-point alignment system. Because there you've got that, but you've also got, you know, lawful good and lawful evil, and it makes perfect sense, you know, to divide it out along those lines. And there are reasons to do that and not to do that, which I get into in the book. Like, for example, you know, because what it does is it increases the complexity and the difficulty of your team. If there are only three cosmic teams, then you get a much more interesting set of strange bedfellows. And I think I even mentioned, you know, Name of the Rose as being the thing that I was trying to do. That in the Catholic Church, in the Name of the Rose, you've got, you know, different monastic orders that are very much opposed to each other in certain ways, but they're still on the same team. And so in your OD&D three alignment system, you're more likely to get that kind of strange bedfellows. Whereas a role playing going beyond just the label of alignment, that in the role playing of those different groups, that there are going to be some real difficulties in dealing with each other, which leads to interesting political situations. It leads to, you know, more player decisions about, you know, do we really want to back these guys? Maybe we want to crisscross, you know, over our alignment, because we, you know, so it's a much deeper, more flavorful kind of thing. But on the other hand, if you're playing with the 9-point alignment system, then you get something that is much more cosmically workable. And, you know, so, you know, I do tend to favor the OD&D approach when you are including the idea that, you know, law also presupposes certain ideas that we would describe, having seen AD&D, that we would describe as being, you know, good versus evil. So, and like I did in all, here's a way you can do it. Here's what that leads to. You know, here's how this actually plays out in practice.
Yeah. And we've seen, you know, Gygax writing that was his intent initially, right? And then he evolved into something else. And in your new book here, you also have a discussion of the Holmes 5-point alignment system as a possible option, and how that works in late original D&D, early AD&D. So I think it's, again, a very thoughtful, very, you know, very solid analysis of where it all comes from and how best to actually use it in the game, which is ultimately the important thing.
Yep. Otherwise, you know, theory.
We are just about out of time, Matt. I wanted to give you a chance to say, is there anything about the Swords and Wizardry expansion's Kickstarter that you need to get out there that that you haven't had a chance to talk about yet?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the main thing that I'm, you know, telling people is, you know, it's all optional. You know, what we're not trying to do is we're not trying to make the game more complicated. We're trying to say, you know, here's a book of many multiple discrete options that can be picked and chosen and cherry picked and, you know, brought into the game to make it more fun. But the official game itself, you know, is still the basic rule book, you know, Swords and Wizardry Complete Revised, because otherwise it becomes, you know, if you tried to play with 22 character classes, that's beyond any group's ability to mentally assimilate. And more importantly, any referee's ability to assimilate all of that stuff. There you're starting to fall into the second edition trap of having a relatively simple game, but so many different options for it that you create complexity in and of itself. So, you know, but as options, I think people are going to find some really cool stuff in.
Cool. Super cool.
Dan, any final thoughts?
Okay, one final question to Matt. You make the point that basically any adventure needs a time element, and we're up against our time right now, so it's on my mind. Do you agree that in order to have a meaningful campaign, accurate time records must be kept?
No, not necessarily, but I do think that you've certainly got to have the feel that there is some kind of race against time. You know, this being something that, you know, goes back to Tome of Adventure Design as well, and it's got to do with adventure design more than the game. But you know, there is, you've got to have a sense of a race against time, and also specifically if you're doing an adventure, you know, your rules have to have, there has to be some sort of disadvantage to being utterly ridiculously cautious in a game. Otherwise, you know, and that comes from the measurement of time. You know, so for example, in a dungeon, wandering monsters, is actually wandering monster checks that establish the most important element of time. Exactly. In a dungeon, is how often are those coming in? Because that's the only downside to, you know, to not being super careful.
I think that's very thoughtful. So I'm personally looking really forward to the Swords and Wizardry expanded rules and the new classes and the updated old school primer and that beautiful referee screen. So again, we'll encourage our viewers to check out the link in the YouTube description. We're going into our last full week. It's already funded. So please go ahead and join Matt's expanded Swords and Wizardry. We'll love it when that finally comes out.
Yep, check out that link in the video description here. It was also posted to the chat earlier in the show. If you have further questions for Matt, I'll just remind everyone once again that right after this, we're going into our live after party chat, and Matt will be joining us. So come join our Patreon at patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier. You can join us in our after party chat and get your questions in.
We'll look forward to that.
Yeah.
And as usual, if the show's over, feel free to add comments in the on the YouTube show. Is that right, Paul?
Oh yes, of course, yes. Sorry, I was more focused on the after party chat, Dan. But of course,
I mean, this is legitimate.
Of course, viewers, if you have any thoughts on anything we've discussed here, further questions that you want to hear us talk about in future shows, please leave us a comment in the YouTube video. Right here, and we'll check that out, and possibly you'll inspire a topic for a future show.
Yeah, and remember, you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites, so please tear down that like button.
Viewers, if you prefer to listen to this podcast in audio-only format, you can find those files at our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find our podcast on various podcast carriers such as iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, a lot of places. If you are listening to the show right now on one of those third-party sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other listeners find us, and we really appreciate it.
It really does. And as usual, a huge thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, like Paul said, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And every single tier gets you on our Discord server where the conversation continues all the time. And importantly, we'll be there in about 10 minutes for our video after chat with Mr. Matt Finch to answer some more of your questions there. So don't forget that Dan's Old Time Mini Show will be back this Thursday. I'll be on at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And again, I'll be preparing, making some molds and preparing to cast some more miniatures in lead live in my kitchen at some future point. So we'll look forward to that. And again, we'll plan to be back next week. But before that, Matt, thanks so much for joining us. I hope the Kickstarter goes great in its last week.
Thank you for having me. And I hope it does great too.
That's the best. We are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.